This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Well, October 2011. I just got back from a lovely few days at the Equinox Star Party at Kelling Heath in North Norfolk, where everything is done to keep the light levels down. It's a sea of little red lights all around the place. You're not allowed anything bright. And it is amazing what you can see if your eyes get fully dark adapted from a really dark site. So I would urge you, sometimes when there's no real moon around, to get somewhere like North Norfolk, North Devon, Mid Wales, or even Galloway in Scotland, where it's really dark. It's amazing what you can see with the Milky Way arcing overhead, coming down through Cygnus. And if it is really dark, you'll see there's quite a nice dark region splitting up the Milky Way. It's called the Cygnus Rift. And that's around, of course, the so-called summer triangle, which we still see very well in autumn, from Altair in Aquila, Vega in Lyra, and Deneb in Cygnus the Swan. As I've said before, if you run with some binoculars up from Aquila towards Vega, you'll find a nice asterism, which is called Brocky's Cluster, or the coat hanger, because it looks just like an upside-down coat hanger. If it really is dark, you'll make out a very sweet constellation called Delphinus the Dolphin, below and to the left of Cygnus the Swan. And above that, there's a tiny constellation called Sagitta the Arrow. If you've got some 10 by 50 binoculars, say, and it really is dark, find the head star, the tip of the arrow, and gently sweep upwards. You may well pick up a little fuzzy blob. It's called the Dumbbell Nebula. It's a planetary nebula. It's what happens when a star like our Sun comes to the end of its life. The central core collapses down to about the size of the Earth and becomes what's called a white dwarf. And the outer parts blow out into space, forming a shell or a torus around the central star. These are called planetary nebula because they look a little bit like planets. It's well seen with a small telescope, but I did spot it with binoculars under the Norfolk skies. Coming across, you come across the Great Square of Pegasus. And that's a good starting point to find our nearest giant galaxy, the Andromeda Nebula. Start at the top left-hand star, it's called Alpharatz or Alpha Andromedae. Move around to the left and up a bit, two stars. There turn sharp right. There's one further star you come to and then another, and then you should see a little fuzzy glow. Easy with binoculars on a dark night, and if your eyes are good and dark adapted, you'll see it with your unaided eye as well. I put a chart on the night sky page that's now up for October, and that will help you find it. If it really is dark and you find Andromeda easily, it might well be worth looking for the third largest galaxy in our local group, called M33. It's in Triangulum. All you have to do, in principle, is to bring your binoculars back down to the point where you turn sharp right and just keep going very gently, perhaps a little bit up to the left, and you may come across a little grey smudge in the sky. That's M33. Although in total it's got relatively high magnitude, the light spread out over quite a large region. So it actually looks to me like a little bit of tissue paper stuck on the sky, a region just a little bit brighter than the surroundings. But it's nice to see it anyway. Well, moving over from there, in fact, late in the evening, we see Taurus rising with that lovely group of stars called the Pleiades. Often I don't really talk about the stars we see in the north, and perhaps we should do. It's very easy to see, to the north and almost overhead, the constellation of Cassiopeia, a rather open W. If you follow down from that towards the constellation of Perseus, there's a very nice region along the Milky Way, and between the two, you actually find what's called the double cluster of Perseus. Little hazy glow is what you'll see with your unaided eye, but binoculars might show two little fuzzy blobs, and those are the two clusters that make up the double cluster. So actually it's a very nice time of year to spend several hours at night. You have the lovely region around Cygnus to see in the early evening. You've got Pegasus and Andromeda, and then you have Perseus and Taurus. And if you will stay up pretty late at night, as we were doing, then in fact Orion will rise, and you can look at the lovely Orion Nebula. Well, what about the planets? Well, this month, really, the star of the show, I shouldn't say star, the planet of the show, is Jupiter. It's going to be rising soon after sunset and will be visible later in the month throughout the whole night. I think about the 29th of the month, it's actually at opposition. It's basically due south at midnight and about 47 degrees elevation. Now that's far higher than it has been over the last few years, which means you're seeing it then through much less of the atmosphere. The views with our telescopes should be absolutely stunning. And I was looking at it at that elevation just the other night, and it really was very good. I cannot think of any better reason for buying a small telescope at the present time just to have a look at Jupiter and its four Galilean moons. It's going to be 50 arc seconds across by the end of the month, and that's because, in fact, Jupiter is currently quite close to perihelion, which means it's nearest the Sun, which of course means it's nearest the Earth. So it's about as big as it ever gets in the sky. The equatorial belts are there. The south one has come back. It was missing last year. And nestling in it, you'll find the great red spot. Not that easy to see, but I have put a list on the website which tells you some times in the evening when the great red spot is actually on the meridian. That's facing directly towards us. That may help you find it. Well, Saturn and Mercury, we don't see this month. Saturn passes behind the Sun on the 18th, that superior conjunction, and we're not going to see that until it reappears in the pre-dawn sky in a month or so. Likewise, Mercury passed behind the Sun on the 28th of September, so it's still behind, and we won't see that either. But we haven't quite finished, because we have Mars. Now, as of the 1st of October, Mars lies in Cancer, and it's basically moving down to the left from the lovely little cluster called the Beehive Cluster, or Praesepe. So it's moving down from Cancer towards Leo. It's about 5.2 arc seconds across at the moment, which is not very big. It is possible under nights of good seeing, you might just make out some of the more obvious details, such as the V-shape of Syrtis Major and the North Polar Cap. But time will come when it's over 10 arc seconds across early in the new year, and that's when we'll have a lovely view, and it will be our star planet earlier in the next year. And finally, Venus. Well, that passed behind the Sun on the 15th of August, and it's still fairly far on the far side of the Sun, so it's 94% illuminated, and it's about 10 arc seconds across. It gets much bigger when it's nearer to us. It's only just visible after sunset at the beginning of October. You might just pick it up if you have a very low southwestern horizon. It's at a magnitude of minus 3.9, so it's quite bright, but low down you may well need binoculars to see it. Venus will be better towards the end of the month when it's actually further away from the Sun and somewhat easier to spot. Well, finally, some highlights. Well, there is one possible dramatic event this month, but it's only possible. If it's clear on October the 8th, that's a Saturday, in the evening, from about 8 o'clock onwards, try and get yourself somewhere where it's pretty dark and you have a very good low northwestern horizon, looking up towards Vega, which is now beginning to set in the northwest, because there is the constellation of Draco the dragon. It is the radiant of a meteor shower we call the Draconix, because they come from the constellation Draco. And they result from the debris released as the comet Yakabini-Zinna goes round the Sun. Now, with the majority of meteor showers that we observe, like the Perseids in August and the Leonids next month in November, the debris, the little dust particles, have spread all round the orbit. So it doesn't really matter too much when the Earth crosses that orbital track, we will pick up a meteor shower. Now, the particles from the Draconids have not yet managed to spread round the orbit, and so we only get a shower when we are relatively close to where the comet is in the sky. And that happens about once every 13 years. And it's pretty obvious this must be one of those years. But when it does, because that material is still pretty well clumped, you can get what is called a meteor storm, which when the peak rate of meteors that you see might exceed 100 per minute, or around 6,000 per hour. That's really quite dramatic. One of these was seen in 1933. Interestingly, in 1946, Bernard Lovell at Jodrell Bank, our observatory, the University of Manchester's radio observatory, detected a daytime shower from these little dust particles, which was also around 6,000 per hour. Now, we do not know we'll get something as dramatic as that, but we don't know how good it could be. The peak time is between 8 p.m. and 10 p.m. on the evening of October the 8th. If it is clear, I do urge you to go and try and have a look. You never know what you might see. But please don't blame me if you don't see very much. There's another meteor shower in October, around the 21st. It's called the Orionids. In fact, it lasts for a few days, so any clear night around that, do have a look towards the constellation of Orion, or above it in the sky is preferable, as that rises late in the evening or in the early morning. Sadly, we'll have a waning gibbous moon, and that will hang in the east, so that will hide the fainter trails, but it's nevertheless worth a try. So before dawn, when Orion's high in the southern sky, you should have a chance of seeing some of the Orionids around that time. They're interesting because we believe they're dust particles released by Comet Halley, the well-known comet. Also, this month, it's well worth searching for both Neptune and Uranus. And I've given you little charts to show you where to look around 24th to 28th of October. That's when there's no moon in the sky. You'll have much better chance to see it. Interestingly, as I think I said last month, Neptune is very close to its discovery position in 1846. It completed its first orbit on July the 11th, but because of the Earth's positioning around its orbit around the Sun, it will actually get back to the precise spot where it was first observed, I think on my birthday, November the 22nd, so I'll mention that next month. So there we go, quite a nice lot of things to look for this month. It is good when the nights get longer, we haven't got to wait up quite so late or get up so early to see the night sky. Good hunting.
Thanks, Ian. And now John Field will tell us what you can see in the southern night sky this month.
Kia ora and welcome to the October Jodcast coming from the Carter Observatory, Wellington, New Zealand. October sees Scorpius and Sagittarius about halfway down towards our western horizon. Below these two constellations we find the two inner planets, Mercury and Venus. Venus will set about an hour after sunset at the start of the month. Mercury will also be in the twilight sky by mid-month. By month's end, both planets will appear close together in the evening sky, and on the 28th of October they will be in conjunction with the crescent moon. In reality, Venus is 240 million kilometres away from us, whilst Mercury is only 210 million kilometres away. Both will draw closer towards us by month's end. Mercury is a disappointing object for a telescope. Different coloured areas on this planet's tiny disk may be observed with amateur telescopes under favourable conditions. Both Mercury and Venus will reveal their phases in a telescope, which will change as the planet orbits the Sun. The Messenger spacecraft currently in orbit around Mercury has been returning high-detail images of the planet's surface. A laser rangefinder has been busy creating a topographical map of the surface, and an X-ray spectrometer has been studying the chemical composition of the surface. After twilight on moonless evenings, the zodiacal light may be visible in the west. It is seen as a faint, broad column of light and is sunlight reflecting off dust in the plane of our solar system. You'll need a reasonably dark sky to observe this, but I saw it quite easily in Rarotonga in late August and pointed out to a number of people. Jupiter is rising in the east after sunset and will be high up in the northern sky by midnight. Binoculars and small telescopes will reveal Jupiter's four largest moons, which will change position from night to night. If you cannot see all four moons, the missing moons, one or more, may be hidden behind Jupiter in its shadow or transiting the planet's disk. The brightest true star in our evening sky is Canopus. It will be found in the southeast after sunset and will slowly climb higher in our southern night sky as night progresses. Whilst it is low down along our horizon, this star will twinkle and change in colour and brightness. This will decrease as it climbs higher. Canopus is estimated to be 300 light-years away from us and 13,000 times brighter than our sun. To Māori, Canopus is Atutahi, the high chief of the stars. Canopus is in fact the second brightest star in our night sky and is only outshone by Sirius. Sirius, though, by comparison, is only 26 times brighter than our sun and 9 light-years away from us. Sirius will rise in our eastern sky after midnight, and when it does, the three brightest stars in our night sky, Sirius, Canopus, and Alpha Centauri, will be sharing the sky along the southern Milky Way. To Māori, Sirius is Takarua, the winter star. The Southern Cross, Crux, can be found in the southwestern sky after sunset, and will get lower as the evening progresses. From New Zealand, Crux will never set, it skirts along our southern horizon. Following the Southern Cross are the two pointer stars, Alpha and Beta Centauri. In the northern sky, we can see a large group of four stars forming the Great Square of Pegasus. This forms the body of a winged horse, and Pegasus was the mount used by the hero Perseus to save Andromeda from a sea monster called Cetus. Epsilon Pegasi is a triple star system consisting of a magnitude 2.9 yellow supergiant star with an eighth magnitude blue companion that is visible in binoculars and small telescopes. Larger telescopes will reveal an 11th magnitude companion to the main star. This stellar system is estimated to be 520 light-years away. Nearby to Epsilon Pegasi is M15, a magnitude 6 globular cluster. While it is a challenge to the unaided eye, it is easy to see in binoculars or small telescopes. And in binoculars, it will appear as a fuzzy star with a nearby 6th magnitude star to guide you. It rises to a bright center with scattered faint rays leading away from the core. It is about 30,000 light-years away from our solar system. As a bonus, there is a small planetary nebula in front of this star cluster, but a large telescope will be needed to see it. Near Aquarius, the water bearer, we find Cetus, the whale. It is found basking alongside the constellation of Eridanus, the river. This constellation is large but faint, and it lies in a rather unexciting part of the sky. The ecliptic is close to the boundary of Cetus and is not unknown for planets to wander briefly through this constellation. In 1807, the asteroid Vesta was discovered in Cetus. Alpha Ceti, or Menca, which means nose, is a magnitude 2.5 red giant star 220 light-years away from us. In binoculars, you will see a nearby magnitude 5.6 blue star that is about 6 times further away. Beta Ceti, Deneb Katos, tail of the whale, is a magnitude 2.0 yellow giant star. It is actually the brightest star in the constellation and 96 light-years away. Gamma Ceti is a beautiful, close double star of magnitudes 3.7 and 6.4 with colours of white and yellow, and this system is 82 light-years distant. Omicron Ceti is a well-known red variable star, and it was recognised by the Dutch astronomer David Fabricius in 1596. It varies in brightness from about 3rd magnitude to 9th magnitude with a period of between 320 and 370 days. At maximum diameter, it is slightly more than 200 times that of our Sun, or roughly the diameter of the Earth's orbit. At maximum brightness, it is an unaided eye object, but at minimum, good binoculars or small telescope is needed to see it. Cetus contains an interesting star, UV Ceti. It is a faint but famous type of erratic variable star known as a flare star. These red dwarf stars undergo sudden increases of brightness lasting for only a few minutes. The outbursts of the flare star component of UV Ceti take it from its normal 13th magnitude up to 7th magnitude. Tau Ceti is the closest sun-like star to our solar system at 11 light-years. Slightly smaller and fainter than our sun, this star has been found to have a disk of debris surrounding it. As of yet, no evidence of planets have been discovered in the disk. Perhaps we are just too early. As of mid-September, the number of extrasolar planets discovered has reached 685, and we may reach 700 by year's end. And on that exciting note, we wish all our listeners clear skies from the team here at Carter Observatory.